May it please the court, Mike Modico on behalf of Mr. Sierra. In Culver v. State, a recent decision by this court, the court enunciated that a probation officer must independently assess the reliability of a tip from a confidential informant or confidential source before that provides the basis for initiating an administrative search. And that's pursuant to the Department of Corrections' own regulations. And in this case, there was no independent evaluation of the tip in this case. And in fact, Probation Officer Cronin admits that. He basically received information from somebody at the Attorney General's office who had received something, some information from a confidential informant.
Yeah. I just want to interrupt you there, because as the briefs unfold, we find out later on that the someone from the Department of Justice was a deputy attorney general.
Yes.
But early on in the stages when they're trying to decide what to do, nobody seems to mention it was a deputy attorney general. It's just this unknown person from the Department of Justice. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think that was frustrating for defense counsel Mr. Deckers, who handled the suppression hearing. It seems everybody in the room except for defense counsel knew what happened because of the Flowers proceeding.
But the Flowers proceeding was later on. But I'm talking about me understanding the record.
Yes.
When it was decided to conduct this administrative search. And it appears that within the Department of Probation and Parole, independent of who received the call, when the decision was made, the decision was based on a call from an unknown person at the Department of Justice rather than a call from a deputy attorney general. Is that correct?
That's what the record shows.
So it could have been a paralegal, a secretary, anybody as far as the decision to act.
That's accurate. So there was no independent evaluation because Probation Officer Cronin admitted that he assumed that whoever received the tip was in the position to evaluate it and take action if it proved to be inaccurate. So basically he didn't even perform that independent evaluation.
When you say independent evaluation, what are you contending that should have been done?
To determine the reliability of the information for the confidential informant, much as the court does when it's presented with a search warrant based upon a confidential informant.
Well, are you suggesting the standard is the same as for a Fourth Amendment search?
The standard is that there has to be evidence to support the reliability.
But because the defendant's a probationer, he has lesser rights than
right.
The otherwise typical citizen has.
Right.
How do you articulate a standard that is different from the Fourth Amendment where there's a requirement that the confidential or anonymous informant be vetted?
In a regular criminal case, to get the search warrant, it's probable cause. In this, there has to be reasonable suspicion. But to focus on whether reasonable suspicion standard is met for purposes of a administrative search, there has to be some determination that the information is reliable. And that's reliability to determine if there's reasonable suspicion.
So as I understood your point, there's a difference between directly ascertaining reliability and using hearsay completely. And in response to Justice Jacobs' question, I thought you would have said, rather than simply rely on the assessment by this unknown person from the Department of Justice, the appropriate response would have been, I need to talk to your informant, or I need to somehow independently verify either the information or their reliability, but that whether or not the standard for the informant is similar or the same as what you'd have under the Fourth Amendment, that in this case, relying on a third party's assessment of the information simply was insufficient under any standard.
Well, that's correct, and if I misunderstood the question, I'm not saying that probation Cronin had to speak directly with the confidential informant, but he had to be able to ask the questions or be provided with information so that he could perform his duty under his regulations to determine the reliability of the informant. He can do that by the information from prosecutor. The problem is he didn't do that. He just assumed, there is no information that whoever gave him the information said that this is reliable information. He just got it, conveyed it. Cronin assumed it was reliable. His duty was to assess reliability by saying, Mr. Prosecutor, Mr. Whoever, how did you get this information? How did he learn about it?
Now, is that a duty under the procedure as opposed to the Fourth Amendment?
That's a duty under the procedure.
Okay. Now, the exclusionary rule that you're asking to be applied is under the Fourth Amendment or some other source?
Well, it would be under the Fourth Amendment because under the Fourth Amendment, the state still has the duty to establish reasonable suspicion to support the administrative search. What I'm suggesting here is there was no reasonable suspicion because they failed to independently evaluate the reliability of the confidential informant.
So it's is it a Fourth Amendment violation or not?
It would be a Fourth Amendment violation as applied in a case of a probation against a probationer. Justify a search of a probationer is not the probable cause standard, it's the reasonable suspicion standard. But if there's a violation of, you need the reliability of the informant to reach reasonable suspicion, and that's what we're suggesting here.
Why is the Fourth Amendment involved at all? If it's contrary to the rules and regulations of the Department of Corrections and its agency within probation and parole, they don't follow their own rules and regulations, why do we even touch on the Fourth Amendment of the United States or the Delaware Constitution?
Well, I guess we could look at it as they're separate, independent, and the constitutional rights are certainly paramount. If there were no regulations, this would be strictly a Fourth Amendment case.
Well, but that's like saying if there were no 600-pound gorilla in the alley, there wouldn't be any danger. There is one, and it is the assumption that every Delawarean should be able to make that its law enforcement officers follow their own rules and regulations.
Well,
and when they don't, there has to be some mechanism for telling them that there's a downside.
Well,
and the downside is whether you want to embellish it with the term exclusionary rule or not because of the longstanding application of that term from Fourth Amendment practice, it seems immaterial to me. If you violate your own rules and regulations or don't follow them, there's a consequence to pay for it. It's the same kind of lesson that's taught when the exclusionary rule is applied in Fourth Amendment law. But why is the Fourth Amendment in play at all here?
Because the probation officer or the probationer retains certain protections under the Fourth Amendment. I agree with Your Honor that the probation officer has to follow his rules and there should be consequences.
The Delaware legislature authorized probation and parole to establish rules and regulations to govern their conduct. In part, those rules and regulations are to keep them a regulated police agency, and in part for the protection of the people that they're regulating. So when they violate those rules and regulations, why does anything else come into play?
Well, the regulations really memorialize what a probation officer's duty is under the Fourth Amendment anyway. I mean, I don't know if I'm following the court.
I'll just move on to something else.
Two questions. One, just to follow up on the Chief Justice's. Are you telling us that the Fourth Amendment analysis or standard of reasonable suspicion is essential to your argument?
It's one.
Is it essential?
Yes, it's one prong of it.
Okay.
And then there's a violation of the much as it occurred in Culver.
Let's assume that we agree with you that the probation authorities didn't follow their own rules. Would that matter in terms of the result, if the record showed that the CI did have information that would justify a reasonable suspicion?
Well, if Officer Cronin didn't perform the analysis to confirm that the source was reliable.
Yeah, but what if the record showed that the source was reliable anyway, even if the officer did nothing, to confirm it?
Well, that would be a violation by Officer Cronin. I don't know how you bootstrap on information that you didn't.
Well, the argument that we're being we're being confronted with by the state is that that this confidential informant was vetted by the Superior Court in the context of a motion to disclose his identity.
Okay. Well,
let me finish.
Sorry.
And I think implicit in that argument, or if not explicit, is the suggestion that the court perforce must have found that this CI was reliable.
Well, you have to bring the due process violations into the mix. My client is entitled to certain protections when he files the motion to suppress. The court can't consider evidence that's not presented in that motion to that suppression hearing. That's what the state is asking the court to consider. Ex parte information that he had no opportunity to cross-examine. We didn't even know that this existed until the state's answering brief. The due process implications of this court validating a search based upon information that was not presented at the suppression hearing, I suggest that.
I think you're talking around my question but not answering it.
Okay.
The question is, what is your response to the argument that the court necessarily had to have determined that the CI was reliable in the context of deciding whether or not to cause the CI's identity to be revealed?
In a Flowers hearing, that's not the inquiry. The inquiry is not reliability. The inquiry is whether he can provide information that is useful for the defendant in his defense. So the court doesn't make a reliability determination. The court determines what the confidential informant. The court makes an inquiry, and after evaluating that inquiry, the determination under Flowers is, can he provide help to the defendant as outlined in the Flowers decision? It has nothing to do with reliability.
Can you, on the federal law, federal constitutional law, state regulation issue, let's assume hypothetically there's a sufficient quantity, I assume it is, 400 grams, to bring this action in federal, as a federal criminal proceeding.
Yes.
In the U.S. District Court, is it your position that there, applying Griffin and Knights, that this would have been suppressed on a record that only an employee of the Department of Justice relayed the information to the probation officer?
Well, I see, then you get into,
as opposed to a police officer in Griffin.
I think the inquiry is still the same. The focus really isn't on the messenger, it's on the source. And is that source reliable? And so, you know, I think it's important because it helps you assess
Griffin suggests that a police officer is enough in the federal realm, that a police officer telling a probation officer, we think there's guns in that house.
Okay.
That's enough as far as the federal government is concerned under the Fourth Amendment. But that is when a police officer makes the referral, so to speak.
Okay.
And here there's no evidence of a law enforcement officer making a referral.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, let me try what everyone else has asked slightly differently. As I understand what you're saying, you have two grounds for your argument. One's the Fourth Amendment, and the other are the state's own regulations. And that you submit to us, you should win under the Fourth Amendment, and you should win under the state's violation of its own regulations. And the Chief Justice question seemed to imply, if you do have these two arguments, do we ever have to reach your Fourth Amendment argument? Why can't we simply look at whether they violated their own regulations, and as we do in most cases, never reach a constitutional question if it can be decided on other grounds?
Well, that I agree. I mean, it we don't have to. We can just use the regulations as a sufficient basis.
But is that correct? You're arguing in the alternative. You win under the regulations, and you win under the Fourth Amendment.
I'm arguing under the alternative. Before, after we finished the brief, the Culver decision came out. This case is virtually identical with Culver, only I suggest the facts are even better for the defendant. The court really focused on the regulations. And so, you know, that it appears that's a independent basis, and we would latch on to that.
Well, this en banc court is the same group that decided Culver.
Yes. I think the facts are even better for the defendant than they are in Culver, based upon Officer Cronin admitting that he didn't conduct any evaluation. And, by the way, the lower court erroneously ruled that she didn't have to make an independent assessment of the reliability, and she made a factual record that's not supported in the record that Cronin did inquire about the reliability when there's nothing in that record. So thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Vice Chancellor, Paul Wallace, on behalf of the State of Delaware. Certainly it was not lost to me 15 days ago when Culver came out, and it certainly wasn't lost to me when I knew the panel that I would be arguing before, that it is the same court. The State suggests that if there is a real deficiency in this case, it ends up being that the judge's ruling at the end didn't comply with Culver. And the reason that's a problem is as this court noted, the majority of the court noted, it really was a question of first impression as to what judges should be looking at. And that comes in part because of the interplay of the state regulations and the Fourth Amendment. And, for instance, cases like Griffin and McKnight, which talk about state statutes and state regulations and how they protect, really, Fourth Amendment rights. The checklist itself really is something that tries to embody the totality of circumstances that a probation officer or probation official is trying to look at to determine whether or not there are reasonable grounds to search. And it differs a little bit also in this case because we have a probationer who is in a different position, for instance, than Culver. And there is somewhat of a sliding scale there. This is a person on house arrest as opposed to probation, straight probation, level 3 probation.
And do you agree that the facts on which they acted were characterized as an unknown person from the Department of Justice has given us this great information? Is that what the probation officers acted on? Information from an unknown person?
No, I don't agree with that. I believe that Officer Cronin, in fact, knew who he spoke to from the Department of Justice and what that person did for a living and how they got there.
I know that, but I'm trying to look at the record because as it unfolded to me as a new reader of this case, you get the impression that everybody at probation and parole said, we've got this call from an unknown person at the Department of Justice who's given us this information that we think is reliable based on their assessment from the Department of Justice. So now we're going to conduct this administrative search. And it's only later, as the story unfolds, that we find out after the Flowers hearing that the person was really a deputy attorney general. And at least for purposes of focusing on deciding this case, I think it's important if it wasn't an unknown person, where do we find in the record that they were acting on information conveyed by a deputy attorney general?
I think, and that's part of the problem with the fact that we had these multiple motions in this case, and actually the Flowers motion was decided first if we look at the transcript of the Flowers motion, actually look at the dates that the matters were decided. The suppression hearing wasn't heard until August. The Flowers information, the beginning of the Flowers information, began in February, and it was before the same judge.
Why is that important? What's important is what the record shows the probation officers knew before they conducted the search.
The problem here is, Your Honor, and look, I'm honestly the state's at fault because during the suppression hearing, having had the Flowers hearing already and the reliability, the identity having been not disclosed, we noticed numerous times that the prosecutor gets up and says, we're getting into this dangerous area. The problem ends up being this. And I think the problem is because the Superior Court was not using the same lens that this court set up for it 15 days ago in Culver. There was never a testimony in the record from Officer Cronin about exactly what he found out, what he was told. I think that there's a fair reading that he knew who the employee was and he knew what the person did, although that we kept getting into that situation of that's going to get us into disclosing.
Okay, so there's no direct testimony that the parole and probation officer knew that the person who was calling him was a deputy AG, is that correct?
No, I think...
No, it isn't correct, or no, there is no testimony.
No, there is no specific testimony as to what that person did.
Yet you just told us that can be inferred. Inferred from what?
I think that it can be inferred that he knew what the position of the person was because he said this was a law enforcement officer as defined by 11 Delaware Code Section 222. Well, you look in there, that's a deputy attorney general.
What is this, 007 or something? What's the problem with identifying the person? Is this some kind of in-house clandestine operation?
No,
somebody's been reading too many novels about the OSS? I mean, what's the problem here?
Your Honor, I'm not going to make excuses for what occurred in that hearing because I agree. I agree with the court that there shouldn't have been that problem, that there should have been more discussed and that there should have been Officer Cronin explaining what he was at least told.
Let me go to what I find troubling. In paragraph 2 on page 5 of the state's brief, there's a nice recitation about how the information was uncovered. But interestingly, there's no citation to the record of the suppression hearing. Instead, it's the letter from June to the trial judge regarding the Flowers proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor.
How can we even consider that? Because that's not part of the record that we're reviewing, is it?
And Your Honor, that recitation is for one purpose and one purpose only. On page 15 of the appellant's brief, he makes rank speculation and says, well, you can obviously infer that it wasn't a deputy. You can obviously infer that it must have been somebody else. You can obviously infer this and that. That was simply had no basis in reality.
Well, I understand why you want to put it in here. My question is, how can I consider it?
I don't think that the court can. And I don't think the court can for that purpose. But the purpose that I think it can is in this circumstance, the question ends up being, and I think the court has asked that question to me multiple times, and the problem is we don't know, what exactly did Officer Cronin know? What facts had he been given?
We know what he did state on the record. We know that he stated that the CI's identity was never communicated to him. He did not know whether the CI was past proven reliable. He did state that it was an identified person rather than an anonymous informant. That was his understanding. And that the employee of the Department of Justice, he believed, had the ability to assess the CI's credibility and hold the CI accountable should the information prove to be false. And he further, quote, assumed that the CI had involvement with substance abuse, had a criminal history, and may have had inducements to produce the information. That seems to be, from what I can glean from the record, the extent to which the probation officer, in this instance Cronin, had information that would allow him to assess whether or not the information was sufficient under his administrative rules and regulations to conduct an administrative search. But that's the limit of what he knew. What else he may have known isn't in the record.
I agree. And
weren't there repeated references to the fact that the Department of Justice person was unknown?
I don't think that Officer Cronin said that the Department of Justice person was unknown to him.
Well, did he ever say the person was known to him?
No, that was never clarified. I agree that that was a failure below.
So in terms of the suppression hearing record, there is no fact or testimony of the informant being a deputy attorney general.
That's true. Absolutely.
So on the record, not only don't we know if the confidential informant was past proven reliable or known to anybody, we don't even know on the record that the person relating the hearsay was known.
That's true.
And on that basis, that's the basis for the ruling.
Well, I'm sorry. I disagree to some extent because Officer Cronin is able to say, look, this is person was law enforcement under 11 Delaware Code Section 222. That I agree with the Chief Justice. There shouldn't be these masked.
Yeah, I think your point, as I understand it, is it's reasonable to infer that Cronin, in fact, knew who it was, but for reasons that escape us, believed he was in a position where he couldn't relate who it was.
I believe that's true. And I think that was the interplay between the Flowers hearing having occurred before and the judge ruling that, in fact, there shouldn't be disclosure, and then this officer being stuck in there trying to answer the questions but trying to or believing that he should have not disclosed more. The real problem here, and if we look to Culver for assistance, is that that hearing didn't address factor one in what perhaps Officer Cronin should have looked to determine the reliability of the information that he was using, and that was the detail given. There simply wasn't that testimony, and I think the reason there wasn't that testimony, again, is because...
Mr. Wallace, before you get into that, Mr. Monica argues that Culver is controlling. It's on point. Do you agree or not?
I don't totally agree.
Okay. Is it distinguishable in any meaningful way?
Sure. First of all, I think it's distinguishable as to our waiver argument. This was a level 4 house arrest person who had as one of their conditions of that he had signed in, and that is in the record, and that's clear. You're subject to a search in your home. This person has a much different circumstance than Mr. Culver did as a level 3 probationer, as a level 4 house arrest person.
The response to that is, yes, he did consent to a search at any time, but not to a search without cause.
Well, the question is whether or not there was reasonable cause, and I'd say that's less than necessarily clear, because a level 4 person is really in quasi-incarceration. It's different.
Unlike other cases that were cited to us where the probationer consented to a search at any time without cause, there's no without cause condition here. What's your response to that?
I don't think that it says it doesn't specifically say without cause. Nor does it say only under cause. It's a little more open.
He consents. Doesn't it say you are subject to search, and his signature is I understand?
Yes.
How is that a consent? That's I understand what you just told me.
Well, I think that it is a consent to the extent that when, as this court has said, probation is an act of grace, and when somebody decides that they are going to take that lesser form of supervision rather than the alternative, full incarceration, that they are consenting and agreeing to those conditions. If they don't, there's an option for them.
If we were just to take the phrase, you are subject to search, the plain English meaning of that to the ordinary person would be, I'm subject to search, but you are also subject to your own rules and regulations before you can conduct the search. I'm not just saying, ollie, ollie, in free. You've got your own governing criteria for when you can subject me to that search, correct?
That's certainly one reasonable reading of the last line. But if you look up further where there's the host agreement and it says you will let, you know, in order to get this level of supervision as opposed to level 5, basically, you will let the person.
Are you saying that the regulations that were applied to Culver, who was at level 3, do not apply to someone at level 4?
I'm saying that there can be a difference when you look at the totality of the circumstances and his expectation as opposed to someone at level 3.
The question we have to answer, and it would be helpful to have your view on this in light of the Chief Justice's question, do the regulations apply to someone at level 4?
I think we have to say it does.
Yes.
Yes. Getting back to the regulations and the difference in this case because of Culver, and I'd suggest that Culver gives the framework, both the majority and the minority opinion. The question is where you put the emphasis in the totality of circumstances that a probation officer may have or may rely upon in determining whether there's reasonable cause. Obviously, the majority believe that the weight in that case, and rightfully so, because we knew much more about the facts of the information that the police officer had and turned over, or more importantly, didn't turn over in that case, and whether or not there were other factors in that totality of circumstances that would have justified the search under the regulations.
Are you making a harmless error argument now? You're not.
No, I'm not making a harmless error argument. The argument I am making, however, is that because Culver has helped and will help a Superior Court judge in determining what they have to do in a circumstance where the initiation of a possible administrative search is based on a tip, is what they have to do is what they have to look at the probation officer's knowledge. And that's the problem here. The problem here is the Superior Court, when it said that it doesn't require an independent finding of reliability of the supervising officer, that it really didn't look. That inquiry wasn't made at the suppression hearing in Culver terms. And that could make a huge difference, because if Officer Cronin is able to tell the Superior Court, feels either free to tell the Superior Court, or those facts are in the record, look, this was a Deputy Attorney General, told me X, Y, Z, you know,
so where
could make a difference.
Where are you going with that in terms of your advice to us on how we should resolve this case?
My suggestion is that based on Culver, that the court should remand it so that the Superior Court can, in fact, make that determination to look at the facts that Officer Cronin actually did know. Because the facts of the tip itself, sometimes they can speak volumes as to the reliability. If, in fact, a Deputy Attorney General, I don't think this court in Culver, and certainly no other court has, and there would be no reason to treat it differently than other law enforcement circumstances, has said, unless Officer Cronin directly spoke to that informant, him or herself,
Mr. Wallace, if
there can't be reasonable grounds,
if contrary to fact, Culver had been decided before the suppression hearing took place, and the same record was made as we have here, would you be arguing that there should be a remand?
No, because I believe that we would have been on notice that what we should be doing is focusing.
What would be the result if Culver had been on the books at that time?
If Culver had been on the books, that's a difficult question.
Answer it.
It probably wouldn't be very good for the state, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I do think that, but I do believe that there are facts that are different.
So you're saying that, okay, because the new articulation of the law came out after there is a possibility that on remand facts would be generated that would save this search.
I don't think there's a possibility. I think there's a probability.
One of the problems that I have with that, although I accept that you know more about what the facts are than the record tells us what they are. Cronin's testimony, and I quote it, it's an assumption that the unidentified DOJ employee, quote, had the ability to assess the CI's credibility and hold the CI accountable should the information prove to be false. The only fair inference from that is Cronin stopped any inquiry because he believed that the DOJ employee had already made that inquiry and there was no need for him to go any further. So he was indeed acting as a surrogate in this case for the Department of Justice as opposed to a police officer. He didn't make any further inquiry because he thought that's good. If I hear it from this DOJ employee, that's good enough for me.
But the problem is, Your Honor, we don't know the totality of what that discussion would be between the DOJ employee and Officer Cronin. And that can make a huge difference, just as in if a probation officer...
What do you mean what it would be? It's already over. It's already done. That discussion took place.
But what the full parameters of that discussion were are not in the record.
Well, unless you take what Cronin's actual words are and assess those, which clearly take the position that he didn't have to make any further inquiry, simply knowing it was coming from a DOJ employee who could assess the credibility and could hold the CI accountable was good enough for him. Doesn't that suggest he made no further inquiry?
The problem is, what did he know from the DOJ employee? Because that can have some internal reliability that may say to him, I don't need to, for instance, run that person's record or something like that. It depends on what the nature of the information is, just as it does in every CI circumstance. Just as the court said in
Okay, so your
program.
Point is it's unfair, or at least it's risky for me to draw the inference from that statement that seems plain to me.
I suggest that given the nature of Officer Cronin's testimony and as guarded as it would be, that may not be the fairest inference to make.
Could you help us understand the procedures philosophically, since we did get to look at the Flowers hearing, you know, in part in the record, and we seem to know what was related to the Deputy Attorney General? It seems like a classic case where after talking to the confidential informant, they could have gotten a search warrant, but instead of pursuing a search warrant, it was decided to call the probation officer. Tell us, you know, why they didn't simply pursue the course of getting a search warrant.
Well, I think, and those are decisions that this court's seen before, and the idea is this: look, when somebody is on probation, not only are they violating the law, they're violating Title 11, or in this case, Title 16, in some other way, but they're also violating probation. And whether or not you should go with one course or the other may have a huge difference in that circumstance. For instance, in Everett, this court found that the police officer out on the roadside then contacting the person's probation officer and saying, look, we've got one of your probationers in hand here, and the person, by the way, just engaged in an assault, was a reasonable thing to do. In this case, it may also be just as reasonable when a deputy attorney general or somebody from the Department of Justice, whoever that person may be, but who doesn't author search warrants, doesn't have a law, doesn't engage in law enforcement in that manner, says, there are different choices here. What do we do? This person, we'll look them up. They happen to be on level 4. That means that they're, you know, basically one foot out of an imprisonment circumstance. Is it better in that circumstance, just like it would have been in Everett, to contact their probation officer and say, look, we've got good, credible information that your person may be violating probation, but not only violating probation, but in a serious way. And what we do know from Officer Cronin's testimony is it didn't come as a full surprise to them about Sierra. In fact, he said they had, in fact, authorized administrative search in December of 2006. This was February of 2007, so within about 60 days.
But nothing came out of that.
They ended up not conducting the search for other. He said for other purposes. My understanding was it ended up being a manpower issue. Quite honestly, he had noted, look, this is a person who has history that we have been concerned may be engaging in drug activity. And I agree there has to be, and the state agrees, there has to be some level of separation, certainly between regular law enforcement and the goals of probation and parole. But it can't be a Chinese wall. There has to be times, just like in Everett, and this may be one of those too, where the right thing to do, the more reasonable course of action is, look, we got this information today, and well, let's take it as a hypothetical.
That was the court's concern in Culver. If you're going to pursue a course that's completely controlled by the Fourth Amendment, everybody knows what the rules are. And if you're going to pursue the alternative course under probation and parole, you at least have to follow your own regulations.
I agree with the court there. But the problem ends up being, and I think it ends up being in that narrow area of Culver, is that we don't know enough about what Officer Cronin fully did and fully know to determine whether or not they did file their regulations in regards to the information they had received. He may not have done other independent searches, but there may have been things internally or that there's some internal reliability sometimes, just as the court knows, when the person is a known person, and that even if it comes from another officer, they have less likely to lie. Just as the court was concerned in Culver and the court was concerned in LeGrand that when the person's just out there anonymously, they could be pulling a hoax, they could be doing this, they could be doing that. But the more that they know, and the more that the first person knows who gets the information before they pass it on, the more likely there is credibility. And the problem is, and there may be some internal consistency, that's another one of the factors that we look at that helps. We just don't know that in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Wells.
Thank you.
Court's asking for a remand because we don't know other information that Cronin knew or failed to articulate. Well, whose fault is that? The state has the burden. He's their witness. You saw the way he responded to questions. He was very coy. He wasn't candid. He gave inconsistent answers. He had an opportunity to reveal the information that he had that supported reasonable suspicion for the reliability of the informant. He acted, and the prosecutor was on board with this, they acted like the person from the Department of Justice was the confidential informant, and they had to protect his identity. The protection of identity of confidential informants does not apply to police or prosecutors. They're the people that conveyed the information. If there was protection, it applied to the confidential informant, and there was no attempt from Mr. Deckers to circumvent the court's prior ruling to learn the identity.
Did you discover any basis for this secretive, I'll call it reluctance rather than refusal to identify? I mean, what's the problem with the Deputy Attorney General forwarding this kind of information?
I don't understand, because if it was a prosecutor, he's basically in the same police as a prosecutor. Basically, what would happen is if I was the defense attorney at that time, I would have asked for an opportunity to put the prosecutor on the stand to determine the reliability of the information that was conveyed to him.
Other than taking him out of the actual active prosecution of the case because he becomes a witness, and there are certain admonitions that attorneys shouldn't put themselves in a position to be a witness.
Right.
Other than that, there's no problem.
I didn't understand it. It was frustrating to watch to read the transcript, and you know, Mr. Deckers is trying to do his job, and he's not getting straight answers, and I can't be any, you know, that's his. He just wasn't getting straight answers. It made this, and now the state's asking for a remand. You know, it renders the prior proceeding a sham. And I think the state is bound by the case it decided to present to meet its burden. And it doesn't get a second bite at the apple just because they messed up and they took a wrong strategy.
Well, one fair way of reading their presentation, I think, is their presentation, after all, took place before Culver was decided. Had they been prescient enough to predict Culver, which is pretty clear who could. It was a 3-2 decision.
Yes.
Could have gone either way. It was a very well-reasoned dissent. It was an unpredictable result. How could they have prepared their case consistent with Culver, which is really what I think they're asking us to do now, give them a chance to see if they could comply with Culver?
Well, Your Honor, there were due process considerations here. My client was entitled to cross-examine, to learn about the identity. If that's the person who can, there wasn't anything preventing Cronin to disclose where he got the information or whether, you know, the reliability assessment. We ultimately, the defense attorney ultimately cross-examined him. The record was made upon all the facts that Officer Cronin considered in making the decision. That record can't change now. I mean, that record's set. Nothing prevented him from making that. And that's really, even if Culver was never decided, the same inquiry is applicable because it's part of the reasonable suspicion inquiry. And part of the reasonable suspicion is, do you have reliable information from a confidential source? And I don't think the state is entitled to a remand to supplement the record other than Culver's, the prosecution in Culver is entitled to do the same thing.
Before you run out of time, would you please address the state's other point that I recall about your client subjecting himself to the search because he's at level 4,
right,
just one step away, as Mr. Wallace characterized it, from incarceration, and one step above level 3. What significance does his acknowledging that he recognized that have in this case?
Well, in the civil realm, those are called contracts of adhesion. I mean, basically, you know, it's take it or leave it. You don't have a choice. It wasn't like they said, hey, you sign this, or if you don't sign it, you're going to go back to incarceration. He flows down to probation. You're presented with this. You have no choice but to sign it. And then I adopt Justice Jacobs' response. You know, you're assuming that you're subject to.
I wasn't responding. I was just asking questions.
Okay. Well, comment.
It's never an unwise move to adopt your position, that's for sure.
to adopt the comment that as to how a reasonable probationer would view that. And, you know, the bottom line is that it's well known that.
Well, is it, in fact, a waiver of the probation and parole department's internal rules and regulations that would otherwise apply to an administrative search had it not been signed?
No.
Why not?
I don't believe that there is a way, because it's not disclosed. You can't waive something that you don't know exists. I mean, I'm not sure probationers know what regulations apply to a probation officer. You can't waive something that you don't know exists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.